it on the dean. But David did not detect the tone or chose to ignore it. "I'm not the person to talk to," he said. "When you're ready, have a chat to Mandy Rao. You know Mandy, she's the counselor. Make sure you tell her you're covered by Don's medical plan." Rosie was about to speak again, but David raised both hands in a double stop signal, and the subject changed to Jean's program. David declined a second coffee. "Sorry, I have to go, but I need to speak to Don about the cirrhosis research. Walk back with me? You're welcome to join us, Jean." Jean, despite having no interest in my research, joined us.
I gather you've finished the component of the study that needs a visiting professor," said the dean.
"There's still a vast quantity of data to be analyzed," I said.
"That's what I meant. It's mainly legwork. I thought you might like some assistance."
"Not if it means applying for a grant. It is generally less time-consuming to do work myself than to get involved in the paperwork required to get help."
"No, you don't need to apply for a grant. In this specific instance."
He laughed and Jean joined in.
"But I've got a postdoc researcher, strong on statistics, on loan to us. It's a bit of a personal favor to a colleague, but there's got to be meaningful work. Not least in case they audit the visa."
"Take him," said Jean.
Jean's publication list was populated by work performed by such people under his notional supervision. I did not want my name on papers I'd not written, but I owed it to David Borenstein to not waste my time on tasks that could be performed by a more junior person who would benefit from the experience.
"Her name's Inga," said David. "She's Lithuanian."
Jean left us, and the dean and I walked for a while without speaking. I presumed he was thinking, a pleasant change from most people who regard a gap in the conversation as a space that requires filling. We were almost at his office when he spoke again.
"Don, the counselor is going to suggest Rosie takes time off.
That's sensible, but we don't want to lose her. We like to keep our students, and she's a good one. The timing's not great. She'll probably need to defer the first 6 months of her major clinical year, then have the baby and come back second semester of the following year. I'd say take the whole year. It'll give you time to work out the care arrangements, which will probably involve you."
I had not thought about this practical issue, and David's advice seemed sound. Some women take a month or two off and come right back and arrange to pick up what they've missed in the vacation.
"I think that's a mistake, especially for you two."
"Why specifically us?"
You don't have local support. If you both had parents or siblings living here, maybe. There's only so much child care you can contract out. I'd say defer the whole year, or the baby will suffer. The study will suffer, she'll suffer, and let me tell you from bitter experience, you'll suffer too."
"Seems like excellent advice. I'll tell Rosie."
Don't tell her it came from me."
The Dean of Medicine, our sponsor, an experienced parent. Could there be anyone with greater authority to offer advice on balancing medical studies and parenthood? Yet I suspect that he was right in recommending I not mention his name. Rosie would instinctively reject the advice of an older male in authority. My prediction was correct.
"I'm not taking a year out of the program," Rosie said when I presented David's advice that evening, without citing its source. We were having dinner with Jean, our new family member, who was making use of one of the surplus chairs.
A year out is nothing in the long term," said Jean.
"Did you take time off when Eugenie was born?" said Rosie.
"Claudia did."
"Then just equate me to you rather than Claudia, or is that too big a leap?"
"So Don's going to look after the baby."
Rosie laughed.
"I don't think so. I mean, Don has to work, and..."
I was interested to hear what other reasons Rosie might cite for my not being able to look after Bud, but Jean interrupted.
"So who's going to look after it?"
Rosie thought for a few moments.
"I'll take her or him with me."
I was stunned.
"You'll take Bud to Columbia, to the hospitals."
By the time Bud was born, Rosie would be working with actual patients, people riddled with infectious diseases, in situations where a baby underfoot could cause life-threatening disasters. Her approach seemed impractical and irresponsible.
"I'm still thinking about it, okay? But it's time they considered the needs of women with children, instead of telling us to go away and come back when the baby's grown up."
Rosie pushed her plate aside. She'd not finished her risotto.
"I need to do some work."
Once again, Jean and I were left to talk. I made a mental note to replenish the liquor stocks. Gene selected the conversation topic before I could mention his marriage. Feeling any better about being a dad? The word dad sounded odd, applied to me. I thought of my own father. I suspected his role in my life when I was a baby had been minimal. My mother had resigned from her teaching job to manage three children while my father worked at the family hardware store. It was a practical, if stereotypical, allocation of the workload. Given that my father shares some of the personality traits that give me the most trouble, it was probably advantageous to maximize the amount of input from my mother. I've considered it. I suspect the most useful contribution is to stay out of the way to avoid causing problems. This was consistent with the assessment of me given by Lydia during the bluefin tuna incident, and in keeping with the medical maxim, first do no harm. You know, you may get away with it. Rosie's a rusted-on feminist, so philosophically she wants you to wear a skirt. But she also thinks she's superwoman. Independence is an Australian female trait. She'll want to do it all. Gene drained his Midori and refilled both glasses. Whatever women say, they're biologically bonded to the baby in a way we're not. It won't even recognize you for the first few months, so don't worry about that. Look ahead to when it's a toddler and you can interact. This was helpful. I was fortunate to be able to source advice from an experienced father and head of psychology department. He had more. Forget everything you hear from psychologists. They fetishize parenthood. Make you paranoid you're doing something wrong. If you hear the word attachment, run a mile. This was extremely helpful. Lydia doubtless belonged to the group Gene was describing. Gene continued. You don't have any nieces or nephews, right? Correct. So you've got no real experience with kids. Only Eugenie and Carl. Gene's children were almost familiar enough to be included in my list of friends, but too old for toddler orientation. Rosie emerged from her office and walked towards the bedroom, making hand motions which I interpreted as, you've had enough to drink, both of you, and it's time to come to bed instead of sharing more interesting information. Gene started to get up and collapsed back in the chair. Here's my last bit of advice before I fall over. Watch some kids, watch them play. You'll see they're just little adults, only they don't know all the rules and tricks yet. Nothing to worry about. Chapter 9. Rosie was sitting up in bed when I joined her.
John, before you get undressed, could I ask you a favor?
Of course, as long as it doesn't require mental or physical coordination. Gene's topping up of my glass had resulted in an accidental overdose of alcohol.
What time does the deli close, the one where you get the smoked mackerel?
I don't know. Why did I need to remain dressed to answer the question?
I'd really love some more.
I'll buy some later today. It was 12:04 a.m. We can have it cold as an appetizer.
I meant now, tonight, with dill pickles, the ones with chili if you can find them.
It's too late to eat. Your digestive system...
I don't care. I'm pregnant. You get cravings. It's normal.
Normal had clearly been redefined. I predicted that finding smoked mackerel and pickles after midnight would involve significant effort, especially as my intoxication precluded the use of my bicycle. But this was the first opportunity I had been offered to do something directly related to the pregnancy. Random jogging in an unfamiliar neighborhood failed to uncover any smoked mackerel. The streets were still busy and my directional choices were being influenced by the need to dodge pedestrians. I decided to proceed to Brooklyn, where I knew there was a well-stocked all-night delicatessen on Graham Avenue. Statistically, my expected time to find mackerel was probably lower if I continued to search Manhattan, but I was prepared to pay a price for certainty. As I jogged over the Williamsburg Bridge, I analyzed the problem. It seemed likely that Rosie's body was reacting to some deficiency, the intensity of the desire magnified by the importance of proper nutrition during pregnancy. She had rejected the mushroom and artichoke risotto but wanted mackerel. I made a provisional conclusion that her body required protein and fish oil. As with the management of my increasingly complex life, I saw two possible approaches. An on-demand sourcing of nutrition, driven by cravings which probably occurred only after the deficiency was recognized by her body, was going to be disruptive and inefficient, as my search for mackerel was demonstrating. A planned approach, recognizing the specialized diet required for pregnancy and ensuring all ingredients were on hand in a timely manner, was obviously superior.
When I arrived home at 2:32 a.m. in the city that never sleeps, I had run approximately 20 kilometers and acquired mackerel, pickles, and chocolate. Rosie always craved chocolate. Rosie was asleep. Waving the mackerel under her nose did not stimulate any response. When I woke, Rosie and Jean were already preparing to leave for Columbia, and I had a headache again, this time doubtless due to lack of sleep. The correct amount of relatively undisturbed sleep is critical to optimum physical and mental functioning. Rosie's pregnancy was taking a severe toll on my body. Purchase of pregnancy-compatible food in advance would at least obviate the need for midnight excursions. As a short-term solution, I took a day's leave to concentrate on the baby project. I was able to use the freed-up day productively, first to catch up on sleep, then to source further information on Rosie's statement about the link between cortisol and depression. The evidence was convincing, as it was for the link with heart disease. It was definitely important to minimize Rosie's stress levels in the interest of both Bud's health and her own. I allocated the remainder of the morning, after completion of scheduled body maintenance tasks, to researching nutrition in pregnancy. The time I allowed turned out to be manifestly insufficient. There was so much conflicting advice. Even after rejection of articles that helpfully advertised their lack of a scientific basis by the use of words such as organic, holistic, and natural, I was left with a mass of data. Recommendations and recipes, some focused on foods to include, others on foods to avoid. There was substantial overlap. A commercial but impressive baby-orientated website offered a standardized meal system for each trimester, but its meals included meat, which would be unacceptable to Rosie. I needed more time, or a meta-study. Surely others had faced the same problem and codified their findings. The pregnancy websites also contained vast amounts of information about fetal development. Rosie had been clear that she did not want a technical commentary, but it was so interesting, especially with a case study progressing in my apartment. I selected one of the wall tiles above the bath and labeled it 5 to represent the estimated number of weeks of gestation up to the preceding Saturday. I made a dot the size of an orange seed to represent Bud's current size, then added a sketch. Even after 40 minutes work, it was crude compared with some of the diagrams available online. But, as with the schedule on the tiles opposite, its production gave me a distinct sense of satisfaction. To solve the immediate nutrition problem, I selected a vegetarian recipe at random from one of the websites. A jog via Trader Joe's sufficed to source all the necessary ingredients for tofu and squash flan. I was left with an afternoon of unscheduled time, an ideal opportunity to do some research in line with Jean's advice. It seemed wise to delay the shower and change until after my excursion, especially as the weather forecast indicated a 30% probability of rain. I put my light raincoat on over my jogging costume and added a cycling hat for hair protection. There was a small playground on 10th Avenue, only a few blocks away. It was perfect. I was able to sit on a bench, alone, and watch children with their guardians. Binoculars would have been helpful, but I could observe gross motor actions and even hear some conversation, especially as much of it was shouted. I was not disturbed. In fact, on the sole occasion that a child approached me, it was immediately summoned back. I made several observations in my notebook. The children explored for short distances but routinely checked and returned to their guardians. I recalled seeing a documentary in which this behavior was made more obvious by fast-motion replay, but could not recall what type of animal was involved. My phone had substantial available memory, so I began shooting my own video. Jean would definitely be interested. My recording was interrupted by some kind of communal activity. The guardians and children gathered together for approximately 20 seconds and then moved to the other end of the playground, where my view of them was obscured by a central island of foliage. I followed and sat where I could observe them again, but they did not resume their play. I decided to wait and use the time to change the video resolution on my phone in case there was an opportunity to film a longer segment. Due to my focus on the camera operating task, I did not notice the approach of 2 uniformed male police officers. In retrospect, I may not have handled the situation well, but it was an unfamiliar social protocol in unexpected circumstances, driven by rules which I did not know. I was also struggling with the video application, which I downloaded because of its superior compression algorithm, without due attention to its user-friendliness. "What do you think you're doing?" This was the, marginally, older policeman. I guess they were both in their 30s and in good physical shape, BMIs approximately 23.
Oh, I think I'm configuring the resolution, but it's possible I'm doing something different. It's unlikely you'll be able to assist unless you're familiar with the application. Well, I guess we should get out of your way and leave you with the kids. Excellent. Good luck fighting crime. Get up!
This was an unexpected change of attitude on the part of the younger colleague. Perhaps I was seeing a demonstration of the good cop, bad cop protocol. I looked to good cop to see if I would receive contrary instructions.
Do you also require me to stand up?
Good cop assisted me to stand, forcefully. My dislike of being touched is visceral, and my response was similarly automatic. I did not pin or throw my assailant, but I did use a simple Aikido move to disengage and distance him from me. He staggered back, and bad cop pulled his gun. Good cop produced handcuffs. At the police station, the officers sought a statement in which I conceded that I'd been in the park observing children and that I had resisted arrest. I was finally given an answer to the obvious question. What had I done wrong? It is illegal in New York to enter a designated children's playground without the company of a child under the age of 12. Apparently, there was a sign posted on the fence to that effect. Incredible. If I had actually been as presumably suspected by the police and anticipated by the lawmakers, someone who gains sexual satisfaction from observing children, I would have had to kidnap a child in order to gain entry to the playground. Good cop and bad cop were not interested in this argument, and I eventually provided an account of events that seemed to satisfy them. I was then left alone in a small room for 54 minutes. My phone had been confiscated. At that point, an older man, also in uniform, joined me, carrying what I guess was the printed version of my statement.
Professor Tillman.
Greetings. I need to call a lawyer. The time spent alone had been useful in allowing me to collect my thoughts. I remembered a 1-800 phone number for criminal lawyers from a Subway advertisement.
You don't want to call your wife first?
My priority is professional advice. I was also conscious that news of my arrest would cause Rosie stress, particularly as the problem was still unresolved and she could do little to help.
You can call a lawyer if you want. Maybe you won't need one. You want something to drink?
My answer was automatic. Yes, please. Tequila. Straight up. My interrogator looked at me for approximately 5 seconds. He made no signs of getting the drink.
Sure you wouldn't like a margarita? Maybe a strawberry daiquiri?
No, a cocktail is complex to prepare. A tequila is fine. I suspected that they would not have fresh juice available. Better a neat tequila than a margarita made with lemon syrup or sweet and sour mix.
You're from Melbourne, Australia, right?
Correct.
And now you're a professor at Columbia.
An associate professor.
You got someone we can call to verify that?
Of course, you can contact the Dean of Medicine.
So you're a pretty smart guy, right?
It was an awkward question to answer without appearing arrogant. I just nodded.
Okay, Professor, answer me this. With all your intelligence, when I offered you a margarita, did you really think I was going to go to the tea room and squeeze a few limes?
Lemons are fine, but I only asked for a tequila. Squeezing citrus fruit for cocktails seems an inappropriate use of time for a law enforcement professional. He leaned back.
You're not kidding, are you?
I was under extreme pressure, but conscious that I must have made an error, I did my best to clarify.
I've been arrested and am at risk of incarceration. I was unaware of the law. I'm not intentionally making a joke.
I thought for a moment, then added, only because it might reduce the chances of jail and consequent low-quality food, dull conversation, and unwanted sexual advances, I'm somewhat socially incompetent.
I sort of figured that out. Did you really say good luck fighting crime to Officer Cook?
I nodded.
He laughed. I got a nephew a lot like you.
He's a professor of genetics.
No, but if you want to know about World War II Spitfires, he's your boy. Knows everything about planes, nothing about how to stay out of trouble. You must have done all right at school to make professor.
I got excellent marks. I didn't enjoy the social aspects.
Problems with authority?
My instinctive answer was no. I am observant of rules and have no desire to cause trouble. But unbidden memories of the religious education teacher, the headmaster, and the dean of science in Melbourne entered my mind, followed by Wineman, the superintendent at the Brooklyn apartment, and the two cops.
Correct. Due to honesty, lack of tact rather than malice.
Ever been arrested before?
This is the first time.
And you were in the playground to, he checked his document, observe children's behavior in preparation for fatherhood.
Correct.
My wife is pregnant. I need to acquire familiarity with children.
Jesus.
He looked at the paper again, but his eyes did not indicate that he was reading.
All right, I don't think you're a danger to kids. I just can't let you walk away. If next week you go and shoot up a school and I've done nothing,
it seems statistically unlikely.
Don't say anything. You'll talk yourself into trouble.
It seemed like good advice.
I'm going to send you to Bellevue. This guy will see you, and if he thinks you're safe, you're off the hook.
We're all off the hook. He gave me back my phone and waved the handcuffs.
Brendan's a good guy. Just make sure you show up, or we do it the hard way.
Chapter 10. It was 6:32 p.m. when I left the police station. I immediately phoned Bellevue to make an appointment. The receptionist asked me to call back the next day unless it was an emergency. Approximately 4 minutes into my description of the situation, she made an apparently irreversible decision that it was not. On the subway, I debated whether I needed to inform Rosie of the playground incident. It was embarrassing, and suggested a lack of familiarity with rules. Knowing the rules is one of my strengths. Rosie would be upset that something unpleasant had happened to me, and angry with the police, in short, stressed. My early decision to insulate Rosie until the matter was resolved remained valid. I had avoided the worst-case scenario at the police station. The assessment at Bellevue was the only remaining obstacle. I told myself there was no reason for anxiety about meeting with a psychologist. In my early 20s, I was interviewed by numerous psychologists and psychiatrists. My circle of friends included Claudia, a clinical psychologist, Jean, head of a psychology department, Isaac Esler, a psychiatrist, as well as Rosie, a psychology graduate and PhD candidate. I was experienced and comfortable in the company of these professionals. Nor was there any reason for the psychologist to consider me dangerous. There was thus no reason for anxiety about the assessment. In the absence of a reason, it was irrational to be anxious. Rosie was already home, working in her new study, when I arrived. I'd missed my stop and then walked in the wrong direction. I blamed the change of location. I began dinner preparation. It would provide a less dangerous topic of conversation than the day's activities.
"Where have you been?" Rosie called out. "I thought we were having lunch together."
Tofu, nutritious and easy to digest and a great source of iron and calcium.
"Hello."
She emerged from the study and came up behind me as I focused on the food.
"Do I get a kiss?"
Of course. Unfortunately, the kiss, despite my best efforts to make it interesting, was insufficient to distract Rosie from her inquisition.
"So what have you been doing? What happened to lunch?"
I hadn't realized lunch was confirmed. I took the day off. I went for a walk. I was feeling unwell.
All true statements. No wonder. You're up all night drinking with Jean.
And purchasing smoked mackerel.
Oh, shit, I'd forgotten. I'm sorry. I had some eggs and vinegar and went to sleep.
She pointed to the tofu, which I was in the process of preparing.
I thought you were going out with Dave.
Oh, this is for you.
Hey, that's nice of you, but I'll get a pizza.
This is healthier, rich in beta-carotene, essential for a healthy immune system.
Maybe, but I feel like pizza.
Should I rely on the instincts that indicated pizza or the website that specified tofu? As a geneticist, I trusted instincts, but as a scientist, I had some confidence in research. As a husband, I knew that it was easier not to argue. I put the tofu back in the refrigerator.
Oh, and take Jean with you.
Boys' night out was defined as being Dave, me, and sometimes Dave's former workmates. However, it was also defined as Rosie having time to herself. The only way of maintaining both components of the definition was to require Jean to eat alone, which would have broken another rule of ethical behavior. Change seemed unstoppable. As Jean and I exited the elevator and stepped into the street, George was leaving a limousine carrying a bag. I intercepted him.
"Greetings. I thought you were returning to England."
An online search had revealed the name of George's cruise ship, which had departed a few hours earlier.
"Bit quiet for you, eh?"
"No, we've got a few months off, courtesy Herman's Hermits. Agents looking for gigs in New York. How's the beer?"
"The temperature is correct and stable. There's a minor leak that produces occasional odors, but we've become accustomed to them. Are you planning to practice tonight?"
"Funny you should ask. Can't say I feel like it, but Jimmy, the bass player, said he might fetch up."
3 days in New York City and he's run out of things to do, so why not get together and drink beer and play some music?
Do you want to watch baseball instead? The idea popped into my head as a solution to the noise problem that George might create for Rosie. It may have been the first occasion in my life that I had spontaneously asked someone other than a close friend to join me for social purposes.
You going out then? He said.
Correct. To eat food, drink alcohol, and watch baseball. We also talk. I had selected Dorian Gray, a bar in the East Village, as our regular meeting place. It offered the best combination of television screens, noise level, critical, food quality, beer, price, and travel time for Dave and me. I introduced George as my vertical neighbor and explained that Jean was living with me. George did not appear concerned about having an extra non-paying tenant. Dave is adaptable to changes in plans and was happy to have George and Jean join us. We ordered burgers with all available extras. Dave's diet is suspended on boys' night out. Jean ordered a bottle of wine, which was more expensive than the beer that we usually drank. I knew this would worry Dave.
So, said Jean, what happened to you today? I had to show your new assistant the ropes.
You make it sound like it wasn't too much of a burden, said George.
This'd be a young lady, would it?
That'd be exactly what it were, said Jean, possibly mimicking George's accent. Name's Inga. Very charming.
In keeping with the primary purpose of the boys' night out, which was to provide mutual assistance with personal problems, I was wondering whether I should seek advice on the playground incident. I wanted a second opinion on my decision to withhold information from Rosie, but it seemed unwise to tell George, who was effectively my landlord, that I'd been arrested. I have a minor problem, I said. I committed a social error which may have consequences. I did not add that the error was a direct result of following Jean's advice to observe children.
Well, that's all clear enough, said Jean. You want to tell us a bit more?
No, I just want to know whether I should tell Rosie, and if so, how.
Absolutely, said Jean. Marriage needs to be based on trust and openness. No secrets.
Then he laughed, presumably to indicate that he was making a joke. This was consistent with his behavior as a liar and a cheat. I turned to Dave. What do you think?
Dave looked at his empty plate.
Who am I to talk? We're going broke and I haven't told Sonia.
Your refrigeration business is in trouble, said George.
Ah, the refrigeration part is okay, said Dave. It's the business part.
Paperwork, said George. I'd tell you get someone to do it, but one day you wake up and find you've been working for them instead of the other way round.
I found it hard to see how such information would become available at the point of waking, but agreed with George's broad thesis. Administration was a major inconvenience to me also. Conversely, Jean was an expert at using it to his own advantage. The conversation had lost focus. I brought it back to the critical question. Should I tell Rosie?
Seriously, does she need to know? Said Jean. Is it going to affect her?
Not yet, I said. It depends on the consequences.
Then wait. People spend their lives worrying about things that never happen.
Dave nodded.
I guess she doesn't need any more stress.
That word again.
Agreed, said Jean.
He turned to George. What do you think?
I think this wine is surprisingly palatable, said George.
Chianti, is it?
He waved to our server.
Another bottle of your finest Chianti, Squire.
We've only got one kind of Chianti, the one you were drinking.
Then bring us your finest red wine.
Dave's expression indicated horror. I was less worried. Dorian Gray's finest red wine was unlikely to be expensive. George waited for the wine to arrive.
How long have you been married? He said.
10 months and 15 days.
And already you're doing things you can't tell her about.
It seems so.
No kids, I presume.
Interesting question. It depended on the definition of kid. If George was a religious fundamentalist, he might consider that a kid had been created at some time between an hour and 5 days after the removal of my shirt on the life-changing Saturday, depending on the speed of travel of the successful sperm. While I was thinking, Jean answered the question.
Don and Rosie are expecting their first child. When, Don?
The mean human gestation period is 40 weeks, 38 weeks from conception. If Rosie's reporting was correct and conception had occurred on the same day, the baby was due to be born on 21st of February.
Well, said George, that answers your question about whether to put her in the picture. You don't want to say anything that's going to upset her.
Good principle, said Jean.
Even without the scientific evidence linking stress to Bud's future mental health, my companions had reached essentially the same conclusion as I had. The news needed to be withheld until the problem was resolved, which needed to happen as quickly as possible if I was to avoid becoming a victim of cortisol poisoning myself. Jean tasted the wine on behalf of the group and continued.
It's natural for people to deceive their partners. You don't want to go against nature.
George laughed.
I'd like to hear you argue that one.
Jean proceeded to give his standard lecture on women seeking the best genes, even from outside their primary relationship, and men seeking to impregnate as many women as possible without being caught. It was fortunate that he had given the talk many times, as I detected significant intoxication. George laughed a lot. Dave did not laugh at all. Sounds like baloney. I've never seriously thought of cheating on Sonya. How can I put this? Said Jean. There's a hierarchy. The further up the pecking order you go, the more women are available to you. A colleague of ours is head of the Medical Research Institute in Melbourne, and he just got caught with his pants down, almost literally. Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Jean was referring to my co-researcher in Melbourne, Simon Lefebvre, and it was good to know that he now regarded him as a nice guy. In the past, there'd been some unhealthy competitiveness. Jean poured the last of the wine.
So, no offence, but Don is an associate professor, and I'm a department head. I'm at about the same level as Lefebvre, but up the ladder from Don. I probably don't get as many opportunities as Lefebvre, whose dedication to the task is an example to all of us. But I get more than Don.
And I'm a refrigeration engineer, which is lower than both of you, said Dave.
In terms of the social hierarchy, that's probably true. Doesn't make you any less worthwhile as a person. If I need my fridge fixed, I'm not going to call Lefebvre. But on average, someone in your profession is going to get fewer opportunities for sex with women who are unconsciously or consciously, for that matter, focused on status. You're probably a better man than I am lots of ways, but in this group, I'm the alpha male.
Jean turned to George.
Sorry, Squire, I'm being presumptuous. I'm assuming you're not the vice-chancellor of Cambridge or an international soccer player.
Too dumb for the first, he said. Would I like to be second, got to try out with Norwich, not good enough.
The waiter brought the bill and George grabbed it, put a pile of notes on it and stood up. George, Jean and I took a taxi back to the apartment building. When the elevator doors had closed in front of George, Jean said,
A free meal. Shows what a guy will do to challenge the alpha male. Do you know what he does for a living?
Rockstar, I said.
Rosie was in her sleeping costume, but still awake, when I entered the bedroom.
How was your night?
She asked, and I had a moment of panic before realizing that no deception was required.
Excellent. We drank wine and ate hamburgers.
And talked about baseball and women.
Incorrect. We never talk about women in general. Only you and Sonya. Tonight we talked about genetics.
I'm glad I stayed home. I'm guessing talking genetics meant Jean giving Dave the men are programmed to deceive lecture. Am I right?
Correct. I consider it unlikely that Dave will modify his behavior as a result.
I hope nobody modifies their behavior because of anything Jean says to them, she said, and looked at me strangely. Is there something you're not telling me?
Of course, there are vast numbers of things I don't tell you. You'd have information overload.
This was an excellent argument, but it was time to introduce a change of topic, shifting the focus to Rosie. I had prepared a suitable question during the taxi ride home.
How was your pizza?
Oh, I ended up cooking the tofu. It wasn't that bad. A few minutes after I joined Rosie in bed, George began drumming. Rosie proposed that I go upstairs to ask him to stop.
I'll go up myself if you won't, she said.
I was faced with three choices. A confrontation with my landlord, a confrontation with my wife, or a confrontation between my landlord and my wife. Judging from his appearance when he opened the door, George must have been playing in his pajamas. I have a theory that everyone is as odd as I am when they are alone. I was also in pajamas, of course.
Making too much noise for you and the missus. And Don Juan.
Just the missus. I was trying to reduce the magnitude of my complaint by 67%. My voice sounded uncannily like my grandfather's. George smiled.
Best night out in living memory. Use me brain. Didn't talk about football.
You were fortunate. Normally we talk about baseball.
Bloody interesting. That stuff about genetics.
Jean is not always technically accurate.
I'll bet he's not, he laughed.
Don't know what the connection is, but this is the first time I've felt like practicing for donkey's years.
Reckon your mate's brought out the alpha male in me.
You're drumming to annoy Jean. People pay money for this. You're getting it for free. I could not think of a good counter-argument, but George smiled again. I'll play a chaser for him and call it a night.
Chapter 11. Deceiving Rosie the next morning was not straightforward.
What's going on, Don?
I'm feeling a bit unwell again.
You too.
I might go to the doctor.
I've got a better idea. Why don't you join me on the orange juice wagon? You smell like a brewery when you came in last night.
It was probably the beer leaking again.
Don, I think we need to talk. I'm not sure you're coping.
Everything's fine. I'll be back at work this afternoon. Everything will be back on schedule.
Okay, but I'm just a little bit stressed too. My thesis is a mess.
You need to avoid stress. You still have 8 weeks. I recommend talking to Jean. You're supposed to talk to your supervisor about your thesis.
Right now, I need to get the stats sorted, which is not exactly Jean's thing.
It was bad enough having to report to him once a month without living in the house and knowing I'm in trouble, and getting my husband drunk.
I'm an expert in statistics. What are you using?
You want to help me cheat in front of my supervisor. Anyway, I need to do this myself. I'm just having trouble concentrating. I get something in my head and suddenly my brain's somewhere else and I have to start again.
You're sure you're not getting early onset Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia?
I'm pregnant and I've got a lot of stuff going on. I walked past the counselor today and she said just casually, I heard the news anytime you want to have a chat. Shit, I can barely keep my head straight with what I'm doing and she's talking about something that's months away.
Presumably the counselor is an expert.
Don't. Just leave it for the moment. What did Jean say about moving out? You spoke to him last night, right?
Of course, I'll speak to him again today. Both statements were technically correct. Elaborating would have added to Rosie's stress. My second attempt to book an assessment at Bellevue was a disaster. Brendan, the person the senior police officer had referred me to, was on stress leave, joining Rosie and me and presumably much of New York in needing to lower his cortisol to safe levels. There were no other appointments available for 8 days. I decided it would be more useful to appear in person, in the expectation that there would be cancellations or no-shows. The clinic was at approximately the same latitude as our apartment, but on First Avenue on the east side of Manhattan. I used the crosstown bicycle ride to plan my approach and had my speech ready when I arrived at the psychiatric assessment unit. The sign above the receptionist's barred window said, "Check in." "Greetings. My name is Don Tillman, and I'm a suspected paedophile. I wish to put myself on standby for an assessment." She looked up from her paperwork for only a few seconds.
"We don't have a waiting list. You need to make an appointment."
I had prepared for this tactic.
"Can I speak to your manager?" "I'm sorry, she's not available."
"When will she be available?"
"I'm sorry, Mr.—"
She waited as if expecting me to say something, then continued.
"You really have to make an appointment. Those are the rules. And you need to take your bike outside."
I restated my case for immediate assessment, this time in detail. It took some time, and she made multiple attempts to interrupt. She finally succeeded.
"Sir, there are people waiting."
She was right. I had a growing audience who seemed impressed by my arguments. I addressed my summary to them. "Statistically, at some time this morning, there will be a psychologist, supported by taxpayers, drinking coffee and surfing the internet due to failure of a client to keep his or her appointment, while a potential psychopathic paedophile is free to roam the streets of New York City, unassessed."
"You're a paedophile?"
A woman of about 30, wearing a tracksuit, BMI approximately 40, was asking the question.
"An accused paedophile. I was arrested in a children's playground."
She spoke to the receptionist.
"Someone ought to see this guy."
It was clear that she had the support of the other people in the waiting area. The receptionist scanned a list and picked up the phone. Approximately a minute later, she said,
"Miss Aranda will see you in an hour if you're prepared to wait."
She gave me a form to complete. A victory for rationality.
"I gather you were anxious to talk to someone," said Miss Aranda, estimated age 45, BMI 22, who introduced herself as Rani.
She listened for the 41 minutes required to explain the events of the previous day. I observed a progressive improvement in her facial expression from frown to smile.
"This is not the first time you've gotten yourself into a sticky situation," she said when I'd finished.
"Correct."
"There has been no problem with children before?"
Only when I was at school, when children were my contemporaries. She laughed.
You have survived so far. If you'd not been a bit awkward with the police, they would have probably just told you the rules and sent you off. It's not against the law to be awkward.
Fortunately, or I would have already been sentenced to the electric chair. It was only a small joke, but Rani laughed again.
I'll write something for the police, and you'll be free to go back to your research about children. I suggest visiting your relatives, which is a good thing to do in any case. Wish your wife good luck with the birth.
A huge burden was lifted from my shoulders. I'd solved the problem without stressing Rosie. Tonight, I would tell her the story, and she would say,
Dawn, I said when I agreed to marry you that I was expecting constant craziness. You're incredible.
Then I realized that someone was looking at us through the glass. It was not until she signaled to Rani, who left the interview room to join her, that I recognized her. It had been 53 days since our encounter, but the tall stature, low BMI, and associated deficit of fat deposits on her face were unmistakable. Lydia from the Bluefin Tuna incident. Rani talked to Lydia for a few minutes, then walked away. Lydia joined me in the office. Greetings, Lydia.
My name is Mercer, Lydia Mercer. I'm the senior social worker, and I'm taking responsibility for your case.
I thought everything was resolved. I assume you recognized me.
She interrupted. Mr. Tillman, I'm prepared to believe we may have crossed paths in the past, but I think it would be helpful if you put it out of your mind. You've been arrested for a crime, and a conservative assessment from us could put the police in a position of having to follow through. Am I being clear enough for you?
I nodded.
Your wife's pregnant.
Correct.
Don't ever have children, she had said.
I had violated her instruction, though not through any deliberate action of my own. I added in my defense, it wasn't planned.
And you think you're equipped to be a father?
I recalled Jean's advice. I'm expecting that instinct will ensure essentially correct behavior.
As it did when you assaulted the police officer. How's your wife coping?
Coping. There's no baby yet.
She works?
She's a medical student.
You don't think she might require some additional support at this time?
Additional to what? Rosie is self-sufficient. This was one of Rosie's defining characteristics. She would have been insulted if I suggested she required support.
Have you talked about childcare?
Minimally. Rosie is currently focused on her PhD thesis.
I thought you said she was a medical student.
Oh, she's completing a PhD concurrently.
As you do.
No, it's extremely uncommon, I said.
Who does the housework, the cooking?
I could have answered that housework was shared and that cooking was my responsibility, but it would have undermined my statement about Rosie's self-sufficiency. I found a neat way around it. It varies. Last night she cooked her own meal and I purchased the hamburger independently at a sports bar.
With your buddies, your mates, no doubt.
Correct. No need to translate. I'm familiar with the American vernacular. She looked again at the file.
Does she have any family here?
No, her mother is dead. She's passed. Hence, being here is not possible. Her father is unable to be here as he owns a gym, a fitness center, which requires his presence. Lydia made a note.
How old was she when her mother died?
10.
How old is she now?
31.
Professor Tillman, I don't know if this makes any sense to your mind, but what we have is a first-time mother, an independent, professional, high achiever, an overachiever. Loss of mother before the age of 11, no role model, no supports, and a husband who hasn't a clue about any of this. As a professor, as an intellectual, can you see the point I'm making?
No.
Your wife is a sitting duck for postnatal depression, for not coping, for ending up in hospital, or worse. You're not doing anything to prevent it, and won't see it if it happens.
Much as I disliked what Lydia was saying, I had to respect her professional expertise.
You're not the only unsupportive partner out there, not by a long way, but you're one I can do something about.
She waved the file.
You're going to do some work. You assaulted a police officer. I don't know how that lack of control translates into a domestic situation, but I'm referring you to a group. Attendance is compulsory until the convener says you're safe, and I want to see you in a month for an assessment with your wife. What if I fail? I'm a social worker. You've been referred to me because of inappropriate and illegal behavior around children. At the end of the day, people will listen to me. Police, I only have to write a report to put this back in their hands. Immigration, I'm guessing you're not a citizen, and there are protocols for fathers we consider dangerous. What should I do to improve my suitability? Start paying attention to your wife and how she's coping with becoming a mother. Lydia was not scheduled to work on 27th of July, and I wondered briefly if that would solve the problem of bringing Rosie in for assessment in a month's time. The receptionist was adamant that it was not a valid reason for non-attendance, and made an appointment for the 1st of August, 5 weeks away. I'd previously been stressed by the idea of waiting 8 days for an appointment. Now I would have 35 days of higher-level anxiety with no option but to involve Rosie. There was a more critical issue. Lydia had raised the problem of Rosie's mental state. I was fortuitously equipped to take immediate action. When my sister died 3 years earlier, I had been concerned that I might have become clinically depressed as a result. With some reluctance, Claudia had administered the only depression questionnaire she had at home, the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale. I'd continued to use the EPDS to assess my emotional state, putting consistency ahead of the fact that I was not a new mother. Now it was the perfect instrument. Despite the name, the accompanying guide specified that it was designed for use antenatally as well as postnatally. If the instrument indicated that Rosie was not at risk, I could present the results at the next appointment, and Lydia would have to withdraw her intuitive diagnosis in the face of scientific evidence. Perhaps with the data in hand, I would not even need to bring Rosie. I knew Rosie well enough to predict that she would be unwilling to complete the questionnaire, and even if she did, she might falsify the answers to reassure me of her happiness level. I would need to slip the questions unobtrusively into conversation. The EPDS has only 10 short questions with 4 possible answers each, so it was trivial to memorize. In the meantime, I needed to spend some time at Columbia after a day and a half absent. I planned to see Jean to raise the issue of moving out, then meet with my new research assistant. My sequencing of the tasks turned out to be irrelevant. Inga was in Jean's office, where he was explaining his research on human sexual attraction. Jean's methods and findings are not intrinsically humorous, but he's experienced in supporting them with anecdotes and comedic observations, and Inga was laughing. I estimated both her age and BMI as 23. Jean considers that no woman under the age of 30 is unattractive, and Inga provided support for this proposition. I took Inga to the lab, without Jean, and introduced her to the alcoholic mice, collectively rather than individually. It is unwise to form attachments to individual mice. Given her attractiveness and nationality, I thought it important to offer a subtle warning. The mice provided an opportunity. Basically, they get drunk, have sex, and die. Jean's life is similar, except for his duties as a professor. He may also have some incurable sexually transmissible disease. Excuse me? Jean is extremely dangerous and should be avoided socially. He didn't seem dangerous to me. He seemed very nice. Inga was smiling. That's why he's dangerous. If he seemed dangerous, he would be less dangerous. I think he's lonely here in New York. He told me he just arrived. We are in similar situations. There is no rule against me having a drink with him this evening, is there? Chapter 12. Rosie arrived home before Jean, which gave me the opportunity to screen her for depression. She kissed me on the cheek, then took her bag into her study. I followed. How was your week? I asked. My week? It's only Thursday. My day has been okay. Stefan emailed me a tutorial about multiple regression analysis. It made heaps more sense than the textbook. Stefan had been one of Rosie's fellow PhD students in Melbourne. He had a careless attitude to shaving and had accompanied her to the faculty ball before Rosie and I became a couple. I found him irritating. But the immediate problem was to situate our discussion in the time frame specified by the EPDS. A single day is a poor indication of your overall happiness. Days vary. A week is a more useful indicator. It's conventional to say, how was your day, but more useful to say, how was your week? We should adopt a new convention. Rosie smiled. You could ask me how my day was every day and then average it out. Excellent idea, but I need a starting point, so just for today, how have things been since this time last Thursday? Have things been getting on top of you? Oh, since you ask, a bit. I'm feeling like crap in the morning. I'm behind with the thesis. There's Jean. I've got the counselor on my case. I think she's being wound up by David Borenstein. I've got to organize an OBGYN. And the other night, I felt that you were sort of putting pressure on me to think about stuff that's months away. It's pretty overwhelming.
I ignored the elaboration that followed the basic quantification a bit. Not very much. Would you say that you're not coping as well as usual?
I'm okay.
0 points. Other problems causing you to lose sleep?
Oh, did I wake you up again? You know I'm a lousy sleeper.
From lousy sleeper to lousy sleeper was no change. It seemed a good point to throw in a random question, unrelated to the EPDS, to disguise my intent. Are you confident of my ability to perform as a father?
Of course, Don, are you?
Improvisation was getting me into trouble. I ignored Rosie's question and moved on.
Have you been crying? I didn't think you'd noticed. Just last night when it all got on top of me and you were out with Dave. It's got nothing to do with you not being a good father.
One occasion only. You're sad and miserable.
No, I'm coping okay, just under pressure.
No, 0. Anxious and worried for no good reason?
Maybe a little. I think I get it out of perspective sometimes.
Oddly, given that this was the first answer that indicated some depressive risk, she smiled. The simplest means of quantifying maybe and sometimes was to reduce the score for the question by 50%, 1 point.
Scared and a bit panicky? Like I said, a little. I'm really pretty okay.
1 point. Possibly you're blaming yourself unnecessarily for things. Wow, you're being remarkably perceptive tonight. I decoded her response. She was saying I'd got it right, hence yes, full points. She stood up and hugged me.
Thank you. You're being really sweet. When we were talking about me taking time off, I thought we weren't connecting.
She started crying. A second occasion. But it was a few minutes outside the 1 week survey period. Are you looking forward to dinner? I asked. She laughed. An extraordinarily rapid mood swing.
As long as it's not tofu again.
And to the future in general.
More than I was a few minutes ago.
Another hug, but there was an implication that Rosie had been looking forward to things rather less than she used to over the week, taken as a whole. The last question was tricky, but I had laid a foundation for inquiry.
Have you thought about harming yourself? I asked.
What? She laughed. I'm not going to top myself over multiple regression and some jerk in admin being stuck in the 1950s.
Don, you're hilarious. Go and make dinner.
I counted this as able to laugh and see the funny side of things, but, considering the full week, there'd been some diminution. 9 points. A score of 10 or greater indicated a risk of depression. Lydia was probably right to have been concerned, but the application of science had provided a definitive answer. As I walked to the kitchen, Rosie called out,
"Hey, Don, thanks. I'm feeling a lot better. You surprise me sometimes."
The following evening, Jean arrived home at 7:38 p.m.
"You're late," I said. He checked his watch. 8 minutes.
Correct. There would be no impact on the quality of dinner, but my own schedule had now been thrown out. It was frustrating to be the only person in the house affected. Rosie and Jean would barely notice the shift. Having Jean as part of our family significantly increased the chances of such disruption. Rosie was still in her study. It was a good time to confront Jean.
"Were you drinking with Inga?"
"I was. She's quite charming."
"You're planning to seduce her."
"Now, now, Don, we're just two adults free to enjoy each other's company."
This was technically true, but there were two reasons I needed to prevent Jean from adding another nationality to his list. The first was the directive from David Borenstein, which I'd been blackmailed into accepting in order to secure Jean's sabbatical. The dean's requirement was that Jean keep his hands off PhD students, but I suspected he would extend it to a 23-year-old researcher, though there is no law against professors having sex with junior researchers or even students, assuming the person is of legal age and the professor is not involved in their assessment. The second reason was that if Jean demonstrated celibacy, Claudia might forgive him, and his unfulfilled desire for sex might drive him back to her. I had expected that Jean would be unhappy at the breakup of his marriage and that Rosie and I would be required to console him. To date, I had seen no evidence of unhappiness on Jean's part.
I was faced with another human problem that would not be resolved without action by me. Over the following week, I attempted to leave the Lydia situation for my subconscious to work on. Creative thinking benefits from an incubation period. On the Saturday evening, after my regular VOIP call to my mother, I initiated another interaction. "Greetings, Claudia." I typed the message rather than attempting to establish a voice link. It was possible she was with a patient. I was operating at maximum personal empathy level, facilitated by isolation in my bathroom office, a recent jog and a pink grapefruit margarita that I was still consuming. My schedule was up to date, and the previous night I had drawn the outline of Bud on the tile for week 7.
"Hi, Don, how are you?" Claudia typed back.
I had changed my view on social formulas. I now realized that they were actually an advantage for people who found human interaction difficult.
"Very well, thank you. How are you?"
"Fine. Eugenie's keeping me on my toes, but otherwise good." "We should use audio, more efficient."
"This is fine," Claudia typed.
"Talking is superior. I can speak faster than I can type."
"Let's stay with text."
"How's the weather in Melbourne?"
"I'm in Sydney with a friend, a new friend."
"You already have vast numbers of friends. Surely you don't need any more."
"This one is special."
Formalities had taken us off track. It was time to get to the point. "You and Jean should get back together."
"I appreciate your concern, Don, but it's a bit late."
"Incorrect. You've only been apart a short time. You have a vast investment in the relationship. Eugenie and Carl?" "Jean's infidelity is irrational, trivial to correct compared with the cost of divorce, marital disruption, potentially finding new partners." I continued in this vein. "One of the advantages of text is that the other person cannot interrupt, and my argument quickly filled several windows. In the meantime, a message arrived from Claudia, thanks to the asynchronous capabilities of Skype.
"Thanks, Don. I really do appreciate your concern, but I have to go. How are you and Rosie?"
"Fine. Do you want to talk to Jean? I think you should."
"Don, I don't want to be harsh, but I'm a clinical psychologist, and you're not an expert on interpersonal relations. Maybe leave this one to me."
"Not harsh. I have a successful marriage, and yours has failed. Hence, my approach is prima facie more effective." It was approximately 10 seconds before Claudia's response came through. The connection was obviously slow.
"Maybe. I appreciate your trying, but I have to go. And don't take your successful marriage for granted."
Claudia's icon turned orange before I could text a standard goodbye message. I was not taking my marriage for granted. After a further week of incubating the Lydia problem, I decided that I could present it to Rosie as an opportunity to receive advice on our parenting. I attempted to introduce the idea over dinner, which of course included Jean, but as I was unable to disclose information about the playground incident, my intentions were misinterpreted. Rosie thought my mention of parenting responsibilities was a reference to her taking leave from the medical program.
"If I was a male student having a baby, we wouldn't even be having this discussion."
"The situation is biologically different," I said. "For the male, the birth process has minimal impact. He could be working or watching baseball concurrently."
"He better not be. Technically, I only need a few days off. You take a week off if you have a sniffle."
"To prevent the spread of disease."
Yeah, I know. But it doesn't change the argument. I just need to find out how much time I can take without having to defer the whole year."
Jean offered a more compelling, if disturbing, analysis. "Rightly or wrongly, if a male student didn't take time off, the assumption would be that his partner was doing the childcare. Are you thinking of Don taking time off?"
"No, of course. I'm not expecting Don to stay home with the baby. I'd not envisaged baby care, but I had not envisaged much at all about life after Bud's birth."
It seemed that Rosie's assessment of my abilities as a father was consistent with Lydia's. She must have seen my expression.
"Sorry, Don, I'm just being realistic. I don't think either of us are thinking of you being the main carer. I told you I'll take the baby with me."
"It seems unlikely that it would be permitted. Have you spoken to the counsellor?"
"Not yet."
I had raised Rosie's idea of taking Bud to work with the dean, and he had stated unambiguously that it would not be possible. But again, he recommended not citing the authoritative source of advice. Rosie addressed Jean.
"Don can't take time off anyway. We need an income, which is why I want to finish this program, so I can have a job and not be dependent on someone else."
"Don's not someone else. He's your partner. That's how marriage works."
"You would know."
Rosie, having complimented Jean on his knowledge, then inexplicably apologized.
Sorry, I didn't mean that. I just don't have time to think about it right now.
It was a good opportunity to raise the Lydia issue. Maybe you need some expert advice.
Stefan's been helping me, Rosie said.
With parenthood information?
No, not with parenthood.